I wanted to read to you guys some verses that out of the Gospel of Luke, chapter 14, at the end of it, because just for, we were kind of thinking for the season of Lent between now and Easter, which is a time when, you know, brothers and sisters in Christ around the world are, you know, just, they just take time to just look. If they don't at other times and say, am I walking this thing or is my heart really in it? So it's kind of a time for that stuff. And so I thought it might be neat to just during these weeks and from now until Easter time to just look at questions. There's over 300 questions in the Gospels that Jesus asked people. And I mean, he knows everything, so it's not that he was looking for the answer. He was just like, do you know the answer to this? And how would you answer this question? And so I kind of thought, if it's okay with you guys, and I mean, I don't know what you would do if it's not okay with you, but I'm going to go ahead with this, but spitballs or something, just kind of ask the hard ones. Like, he asked some hard questions. And just take the season of Lent to let our Lord ask us difficult questions. And this one is in the Gospel of Luke in chapter 14. Large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, if anyone comes after me and doesn't hate his father and his mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. If anyone doesn't carry his cross and follow me, he cannot be my disciple. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. It was like a tower that, you know, normally it was for protecting, you know, protection, like a tower over to protect your fields or to see if an enemy's coming or a place where you could hide if somebody was coming. Here's the question. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? And if he lays the foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, this fellow began to build something and he wasn't able to finish it. Suppose a king is about to go to war against another king. Here's a question. Will he not first sit down and consider whether he's able with 10,000 men to oppose the one coming against him with 20,000? And if he's not able, he'll send a delegation while the other is still a long way off and will ask for terms of peace. In the same way, any one of you who doesn't give up everything he has, cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how will it be made salty again? It's neither fit for the soil or for the manure pile. It is thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear. Lord, I don't know if we do, but I want to. I don't know if I have ears to hear this, but I want to. I want to understand it, and I want to, I think about how Jeremiah said that nobody can really know the depths of their own heart, and so I don't know. You know, I might think that I know the answers to some of these questions, but I might not really. And so I ask you to help all of us, you know, to help me, to help all of us to understand that if I think I know the answer to some of these questions and I really don't, I need to know that. And but these words are scary, and I ask you to give us the courage to face them. Men and women and boys and girls in Christ Jesus around the world are walking this walk with great courage. We want to be among them. We want them one day to be proud of us as we are proud of them. In Jesus' name, amen. You know, Tina and I have been doing this thing where, we've kind of taken a break because of March Madness, but we've been watching these DVDs. It's like 22 hours long on the history of baseball, and it was like a PBS thing. I am learning so much stuff about baseball. It's more than really a person needs to know. But that baseball, 18, the story, the reason that the Baseball Hall of Fame is in Cooperstown, New York, in upstate New York, is because in 1849, there were these two private schools on the Otsego Lake, which I didn't even know was there, and they were playing baseball between them. And one of the players on the Otsego Academy, named Abner Doubleday, apparently sat down and said, "We don't even know how to play the rules of this game. I mean, it doesn't even have any rules. There weren't any foul lines. They didn't." And so he just sat down right there and said, "These are the rules. First, we're coming up with a name." They called it one old cat, two old cat, goal ball, goat ball, barn ball, soak ball, stick ball, burn ball, and they called it base. He said, "Baseball, okay, it's going to be baseball. We're not calling it barn ball." Because, like, they didn't, and these are the lines, you know, because if the ball went in the barn, I guess that's how you got a home run, like the goat ate it, and they called it goat ball. But he's like, everybody agreed, baseball, and he made all the rules up. Although, apparently that never happened because Admiral Doubleday was at West Point at the time and never claimed to have ever had anything to do with baseball or to have ever seen a baseball game. So there you go. The you know, this is, I didn't, the poem Casey at the Bat, you know, "There is no joy in Mudville, Mighty Casey has struck out," that was written in 1888, which I would have thought like 1948, but it was 1888. If you're ever on Jeopardy, you never know, you know, might come up. But there was a guy, this guy who's Lewis and Clark, tried to teach base to the Indians. There you go. It's super old. But there was a guy named Pete Browning who played for the Louisville Eclipse in 1884. And he was kind of famous for, one, he was like 341 lifetime average. And he drank every game during the whole game because he had like earaches and stuff. But one time he broke his bat. And so there was this guy who was a woodworker there named Bud Hellerich. And he said, "I'm going to make you a bat." The next day he went 3 for 3. And he said, "I want a lot of those bats." And so he made him 200 bats. He called him the Louisville Slugger. And he gave every one of his 200 bats a biblical name. I just think that is useless. But it's true. There was a guy who actually, he played for the New York Highlanders, who became the New York Yankees. And he has he still holds the record as a catcher for the most bases stolen on any catcher, 13. But he was a guy who loved Jesus. And he actually, at one point, was going to substitute for William Jennings Bryan and debate Clarence Darrow at the Scopes trials and defend the fact that God made our world. And his name was Branch Rickey. And he became the owner of, he became the manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers. And he was, at one time, he was the coach of the Ohio Wesleyan baseball team. And there was an African-American player on his team who wasn't allowed to stay in the hotel with them when they traveled to Notre Dame. And he arranged for that, it was his catcher, to sleep on a cot in his room, and the kid was just crying, and he said, "It's my skin. I can't do anything about my skin." And Branch Rickey said, for 41 years, I heard that young man crying in my mind, and I determined that I was going to do something about it. So when he became the manager of the Brooklyn Dodgers, there was a player who played for the Kansas City Monarchs, which was the African-American league, named Jackie Robinson. And a year before Harry Truman integrated the U.S. military, 8 years before Rosa Parks wouldn't get up from her seat in Montgomery, 16 years before the "I Have a Dream" speech, Branch Rickey said, "I'm going to have an African-American player on my team." And none of the other owners, people went crazy. But he had him come to his office in Brooklyn. And they had a 3-hour conversation. And Brent and Jackie Robinson loved Jesus too. And he said, I not only need a great player, which you are a great player, but I need a player with guts. And I need a player who can take some stuff. Because this is what is going to happen to you. And Branch Rickey, he took his coat off. And he said, you're going to go into a hotel. And the hotel clerk is going to say, and he started yelling at him, get out of here. And he said, you're going to try to get on a train. And the porter is going to start yelling at you. And they said that Branch Rickey put his fist in Jackie Robinson's face. And he was a man who never, because he loved Jesus, he never said any words that were bad. He cussed him and screamed at him. And they said he said every cuss word in the English language. And then he said, can you take it? Can you take this? Because I want a man who will not answer back to any of that for 3 years. And Jackie Robinson thought about it. And he gave him a copy of The Life of Jesus that was written by an Italian author named Giovanni Papini. And he showed him the part where our Lord said, if anyone slaps you on one cheek, turn the other. They take your coat. Let him have your coat as well, you know. And Jackie Robinson said, I will. And there was a time after he retired from baseball, Jackie Robinson, who was totally awesome. And he made it for those 3 years, and it was amazing. But when he retired, and he got involved in the civil rights movement in 1965, Branch Rickey was 83, and he sent him a telegraph. He was in a wheelchair with a heart condition, and he said, I wish I was at Selma marching with you. And Robinson wrote him back and said, Mr. Rickey, things have been very rewarding for me, but if it hadn't have been for you, nothing would be possible. Even though I don't write you very much, you are always in my heart. Anyway, we feel so close to you, and I'm sure that you, I am sure you know that our love and admiration is sincere and dedicated. Please take care of yourself. You know, and I don't know, like it seems like Jesus is kind of saying to people in those verses that we read, you know, count it up. Don't do this if you can't do it. Is he asking people, do you have what it takes to walk with me? And it's like, but, I mean, the stuff that you're saying is impossible. Like, don't do this if you can't do it. Like, don't do it if you can't pay the price or whatever. Well, what happened to come? Like, what happened? You used to say that all the time. Come, everybody that's weary and heavy laden. Let the little children come. I mean, what happened to that? This seems like it's something that's not appropriate for children under the age of 13, this thing that you're talking about. When did Jesus turn into mean Jesus? It's just like, you know, hate, what's this hate stuff? Like hating your father and mother, hate your wife and kids, hate your brothers and sisters. If you want to be my disciple, you have to do that. I thought this was about love. I thought that's how people knew you're my disciples, because of love, not because of hating. And, you know, marriages, I mean, you're all about that. The very first miracle that Jesus ever did in his, you know, when he was on earth was at a wedding. And a wedding is a time. Their weddings were awesome, by the way, that they would have. The only people who knew the day of the wedding were the groom and the groomsmen. And then they would decide. And then they would go to the bride's house on their thing when they said, it's time to do this. And she would have to, like, get ready on the spot and with all of her friends, you know. And they would dress them all up and they would ride through the city on a horse and throw candy at people. I think that is the wedding parade is like the most awesome thing ever. But, you know, then they would have a wedding where they swore to, by the power of God, to love each other until they were dead. It's all about that, taking vows that I will love you until you're dead. My personal belief is that I think I might have told you all this, but I think weddings would be better if the only people who knew were the groomsmen and the bridesmaid, and they like go to the groom's house at, you know, 3 a.m, wake him up, get him out of his bed. He can't change his pajamas, can't comb his hair, can't brush his teeth. Take him to her house right as the bridesmaids wake her up. She can't change out of her pajamas, can't do her hair, can't put on her makeup, can't brush her teeth. play a recording of a baby screaming, and then say, okay, are you ready to promise this, you know? But I mean, if Jesus wasn't about love in weddings, he could have, you know, the wedding, they had a wedding party that lasted 4 or 5 days, and there was dancing and singing and a lot of wine, and the wine was about to run out, and he did a miracle and turned it, 120 gallons of water, into wine. I mean, if he wasn't about love and marriage, he could have, you know, turned it into purple milk of magnesia. You know, let's end this thing in about 40 minutes. You know what I mean? There was a funeral one time. A mom had lost her son. And, you know, isn't that about love, moms and dads and kids? And this funeral party was going out of the town. They were going to bury this boy. And Jesus stopped it. And he said something. And, you know, normally stuff that people say at funerals is the stupidest stuff, you know, that anybody will ever say. Death is just a part of life. That is the stupidest thing, you know, a person could say. I remember one time I was at a funeral for a young person. And during the funeral, the minister said, I'm just going to open it up. And I was like, no. I'm just going to open it up for anybody to say anything that they want to say to the parents. I was like, don't do this. And he shouldn't have. And, you know, people said, I just think that you should be happy for the, you know, 17 years you had instead of crying about the years you won't have. And I'm, see, that's why you shouldn't have done that. People are going to say stuff like this, you know. But Jesus said to the young man, get up. And he did. And he hugged his mom. And isn't he all about, you know, about that? At one time at the grave of two sisters had lost their brother. And because they loved their brother and they were brokenhearted. And Jesus went there with the intention of raising him from the dead. And he's like, you know, and he didn't go there and say, guys, I'm here. I'm about to turn this funeral into a party. I'm about to turn your saddest day into your gladdest day. You know, he didn't, although that's what he did do. But when he just saw those sisters just grieving for their brother, he just wept with them, knowing that they would all be dying laughing, you know, in about 10 minutes. But it's just because isn't love good? What is this about hating? What is this about taking up your cross? Taking up your cross or you can't be my disciple. I thought, they knew when you talk about a cross, what that was, because they saw it all the time. I mean, the Caesar or the Roman governor, whatever, it was a way of saying, this is what happens to anybody who defies me. And they would, you know, people would be crucified by the side of main thoroughfares, so that everyone could see it. Sometimes if there was massive amounts of people that were going to get it, they wouldn't make crosses. They would just nail people to trees, to walls. And parents with kids, thankfully having two parents, one to put, you know, their hands over their eyes and the other over their ears to hear the screaming. That's what there was a woman when we lived in Italy that was in our church, and she was, you know, she would have been in her 70s today, but the only English that she knew was the song You Are My Sunshine that she learned from American soldiers who were stationed in her town, Montecatini, when they were fighting with Patton, you know, moving the Nazis north. And one time she said she was going to school at about 11, and the Nazis had found a band of resistance soldiers and had hung them all. And she was going to school, and that's what she saw. And, you know, she said, it's in my mind. You know, from trees on the road to school. You know, and it's like, I thought you said, you know, if anybody believes in you, out of their innermost being will flow streams of living water, and now you're talking about streams of blood. I don't get it. This seems so, you know, what about the deal that you have to give up everything you own to be my disciple? I thought this was free. I thought they were going to say, you know, that this is a free thing, that Jesus, the reason he died and rose again, was to offer to whoever wants it a complete forgiveness of everything you've ever done to or will do in an instant, and it's a gift, it's free, you don't have to pay anything for it. What's up with have to give up everything you own? I don't get it. There, I don't know if you all noticed this, but you don't get any more of those publisher clearinghouse as much as you used to, saying that you've won $1 million, you know, that sweepstake thing. Because in 2001, 31 attorneys general, however you say it, did a class action lawsuit against the publisher's clearinghouse, and they won, and they said you can't tell someone because a couple on their 50th anniversary finally got to go to Hawaii, and their daughter said, you've won $1 million, and they came home on the third day of their vacation, of their lifelong vacation. And they said, you can't tell people something that they've won something if they have it, that they have something if they don't, or that something is free if it costs them money. And it's like, so what is this? You know, all this stuff that Jesus is saying, you know, that seems so difficult about being his disciple and all of that. Are we like, you know, I think that their mind, they were like, we've been following you for a long time. Are we learning about the real you now? It's kind of like, you know, the Wizard of Oz, you know, that he'll give you this stuff. You know, if the wizard is a wizard, who will save? You know, and then you get there and it's just a big head, you know, with veins sticking out. He has a bigger vein than Julie Roberts does, you know, in the forehead. He's saying, come forward. You know, it's like, wow, the real wizard, you know. And it's like, are we just getting to know the real Jesus? And in a way, yes. When he was saying those things, the guys that followed Jesus, their whole time was a process of getting to know him. In John chapter 1, from the very first day that John met Jesus, he said it was the 10th hour, I'll never forget it. And, you know, he was looking for the Messiah. He was looking for the one that in Psalm 2 it says, when you see him, fall down and kiss him. Kiss his feet. You found the one of all the world. And when they first met Jesus, they didn't really do that. But Jesus was maybe something they didn't expect as the Messiah. He was kind of plain looking. He was, Isaiah 53 says, he wasn't anything really attractive about him. If we were to see Jesus, pictures of Jesus, they say he's the most recognizable face in the world, but nobody really knows what Jesus looked like. If we were able to see what Jesus really looked like when he walked on our world, I think that most of us would say he was browner than I would have expected because he was Middle Eastern. He had a beard. We know that from Isaiah chapter 50, a prophecy about plucking it out. He was poor. He was probably shorter than we would have imagined, just because back then, I mean, we're the tallest people that have ever lived. I mean, if you were 5'2", you were like, you know, center on somebody's team back then. Everybody was short. He might have looked older than his age, because in John chapter 8, some people said, you know, you're not yet 50 years old. And he really was about 30 years old. So, but one thing that they learned about him, though, that day was, the Messiah, even though he's not, you know, spectacular looking, he was caring and giving, because he said to them, what are you guys looking for? And they said, where are you staying? He said, come on over and just hang out. And it's like, this is the most important person who's ever lived. And he says, I've got time for you. And so they started to follow him around, and they were there when he did the first miracle, when he did a miracle at a wedding where he turned water into wine. That's something that only God can do. God does that all the time. He turns water into wine every day when, you know, it rains and it falls into the ground and it goes into vines and they grow grapes and people collect them and stomp them and gather the juice and put it in bottles and wait a while and it turns into wine. But this is like time lapse, you know, just like making it happen, bam, like that. And then doing it in such a way that nobody knew that he was the one who did it. And the reason was because this was a young bride's day. This was the day for the spotlight to be on her. And they're like, this one is the living God. And he is loving. and giving. They watched as he talked to a woman that nobody would have talked to, just reaching out to her, and then told her secrets that only God could know. And they're like, wow, this one is, he is the living God. The Messiah is the living God. And he's loving and giving. And at a certain point, he said, guys, why don't you follow me full time? And they said, 9 months ago, we wouldn't have done this. But the more we learn about you, the more it brings us to a choice, you know, that we've got to be with you. And when they started following him around full time, there was an explosion of miracles that he did. In Mark chapter 1, it kind of ends. It's a long day, and the sun is setting on a house that was Peter's mother's house. It was like a sea of miserable, sick, smelling people, you know, because they're bandages and stuff. It was like a sea of misery as the sun is setting. And he was healing all of them. And it was kind of like the people that were healed just dancing and singing and jumping and going home. They were like dolphins that were just jumping out of this sea of misery. There's a place in Luke chapter 6 that said essentially, Jesus healed everybody who was sick in Jerusalem and Judea and into the parts of Lebanon, in Tyre and Sidon and beyond the Jordan. Everybody. He healed everybody. And the way he did it, there was one time, there was a guy who was an important guy, and he had a daughter who was 12, and she was going to die because she was very sick. And they said, come help. Okay, I'm coming, I'll come. And he was taking Jesus to his house, and a bunch of people, and there was a woman, and she had been sick for 12 years with like this endometriosis, kind of a gynecological thing, just, you know, just really, really sick. So one person, we've got very little time. One woman had a problem. It had been going on a long time. When somebody has a problem that has to be solved like that, they can easily become desperate. When somebody has a problem that's been going on and on and on with no solution, they can easily become despondent. And so, you know, for one person, their temptation is just, if you've got a little time, I got to have a solution, you're going to take over and do something stupid. If it's been going on a long time, your temptation is to give up. And so, you know, the word for her was just step, one more step. Grab a hold. Don't give up yet. One more step. And she grabbed and Jesus stopped and said, who is that? Who did it? You know, he knew. And she came forward. And the guy's like, come on, come on, come on, come on. We got to go. Come on, we got to go. And then they said, you know, to a person who's despondent, his word for you is step. One more step. When a person is desperate, his word is stop. Wait. I'm going to take care of this. And he went to her house. They said, she's, way to go. She's dead. And he went into her room and he said, little lamb. And she, and they're like, wow, he is amazing. He is the living God. And he is loving and caring. And that's when, in Luke chapter 9, verse 51, it said, that's when Jesus turned towards Jerusalem. It was about 6 months before the end of his time on earth. And he took his guys up on to a retreat. They went up into Lebanon to get away from everybody, and they went on a retreat. And he said, we need to nail some things down. He said, guys, who do people say that I am? Well, some people say you're this, some people say you're that. Who do you say? And they said, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Which is really something that was said the first day that he ever met them 2.5 years before. That's nothing new. But I think the new thing was the Messiah, the Son of the living God, is you. We never imagined it would be you. Someone so loving and giving. And that's the first time that Jesus began to tell them that the Son of Man had to go to Jerusalem, that he would be betrayed. They had never heard this. And that he would suffer and that he would be killed. That was the first time, and that he would rise from the dead. They had never heard that up to this point. He said, it has to happen. Technically, that isn't true. It was a choice that he made. He didn't have to do it. But if we were ever going to be what he wanted us to be, if we were ever going to be where he made us to be, he would have to do it. And Peter said, Lord, no. In fact, in Greek, Peter said, Lord, have mercy. I don't want to hear this. And I almost think that the reason he said, I don't want to hear this, is because everything that we learn about you takes us to a point of decision. That you would love us that much, we have to love you back. And if you love us, if now we're finding out that the living God who was loving and giving is going to be the dying God, who is going to love us to the point of death and give to the point of giving everything for us, what is that going to cost me? If I receive that love, love demands love, and it's going to cost. And Jesus said, that's right. That's the very first time he said, if you want to follow me, there's a cross waiting for me. It's the place where, you know, basically it means I am so devoted to the Father's will and so in love with you that I'm giving all for you. And if you want to follow me, if you want to do this the way, you know, it's healthy to do it. That love is lived. There's a cross for you. Which means if you're going to do this right, you have to be so devoted to the Father's will that, and so in love with me that you give everything to this relationship. There's a cross for me and there's a cross for you. My cross is not like your cross. When Jesus, the cross he took was the cross where he gave his life for people who are selfish and mean. We give our life for the sweetest heart that ever lived. His cross ended in death because he died and rose again. The cross that we live for him will never die. It might look like we do one day, but we won't be dead. His cross meant that in 3 hours of desperate darkness, the Father turned his heart and his face away from Jesus. Because Jesus took that one, no matter what we go through for him, that'll never happen. His cross for us was where he became sin. The purest heart became evil for us. When he was there taking our evil, he became that. When we take up our cross for him, we become like him. You know? It turned out, you know, when we got into this thing, some of us, what we wanted was, I need to be forgiven of all my junk in my life, or I'm looking for answers to my problems. I want God to help me. I want meaning in his life. What he wanted the whole time was people who wanted to be like him. Because in your heart of heart, that's really what you want. You didn't know it, but that's what you wanted. There's a thing that when people believe in Jesus and they fall in love with Jesus and then they want to be more like him, it's kind of amazing. It only happens in this one thing. Because God made you into a unique personality, he gave you a unique body, a unique... In Psalm 139, it says, you created my innermost being, my personality. It's the word kidneys, but they thought your kidneys... was, you know, like we say heart, they said kidneys. I left my heart in San Francisco. I left my kidneys there. I left my stomach there one time going down the, it was in Chinatown, but down those hills. But it's like your personality. You have a unique personality. And as you become like Jesus, the more you become like him, all of us, the more you become the unique person that God made you to be. The more you become the gift to the world that God intended you to be. And you find out that's what you wanted all along. That's what everybody wants of you. You know, it's like what he wanted, and he says what he wanted was love. In Matthew, when he says that thing about you have to hate your father and mother and your wife and kids, Matthew puts it in a different way. It's like, I don't mean hate. You know that he doesn't mean hate. But he means you have to love your wife and your father and anybody loves your father and mother more than me, your wife and kids more than me, your brother and sisters, your friends more than me. You can't be my disciple. You have to love me more than everyone. The reason is because, you know, fathers and mothers, they have expectations. We have expectations of our kids. Our parents had expectations of us. Sometimes, for me to be what Jesus wants, I've got to ignore my parents' expectations. Sometimes kids, to be what Jesus is calling them to be, have to rebel against their parents. because their parents have expectations of them that Jesus doesn't want. He wants something else from them. And we force them to do it sometimes. Some, you know, brothers and wife and kids have demands on us. And we have to love Jesus more because sometimes we can't do those things. Brothers and sisters, they're kind of our peers. They have opinions of us and what will they think of us. And I have to get to a place where I love Jesus more and I don't really care about your opinion of me. And that's what they want. That's really what they want from me more than anything. They want me to love Jesus more than them. You know, Jesus' mother in the Gospel of Mark, she didn't really understand him very well. She had expectations. She didn't want him to leave home. And because she had expectations of him that he'd keep the family business going and stuff and not do this thing that he was doing. Jesus' brothers had opinions of him. They thought he was ridiculous and they thought he was crazy. They all came down to take him home one time. And he said, my brothers and sisters, my fathers and mothers are the ones who do the will of God. And they're like, why do you hate us? Seems like hate to us. They eventually understood what he was all about. They eventually trusted in him. Jesus' mother and Jesus' brothers. They worshiped him eventually after he was risen from the dead. They're in heaven today. If Jesus had given into his mother's expectations and his brother's opinion, they would be in hell today. Sometimes a mate, you know, or someone you're going with, they have demands of you. And if you're going to follow Jesus, you can't meet them. You have to love him first. And you might have to say to someone, I can't do this. He's calling me to be something else. He's calling me to follow him. And I love him more than I love you. It's what they really want. They don't know it. The hardest time that Tina and I ever had in our marriage was the summer of 1983. Wow. But I was a really, really insecure person. And I had a lot of needs for self-worth and all that junk. And I used to try to get her to meet those needs for me, to make me feel loved and make me feel, you know. We were in seminary at the time in Indiana, and I was taking a class by this guy named Larry Crabb who was teaching up there, and he said, you got to let God fill up your, you know, inside, because otherwise you'll try to get other people to do it, and they can't do it, and you're driving them crazy. And she said, you're driving me crazy. You have got to let Jesus love you. You're asking me to do something for you that only he can do. And you're smothering me. I can't do it. I love him. You've got to love him more than you love me. I do. I love him more than I love you. That's why I don't drive you crazy to try to get you to do stuff, because he's doing it for me. You've got to do that. And she was right. And I'm so much better than I used to be at that stuff. But, you know, it's just... turned out, that's what he always wanted. He wanted you to be like him. He wanted you to be a disciple. And he wanted you to love him most, more than anybody else in your life. And it turns out, that's really what you want. In Mark chapter... in Matthew chapter 16, when Jesus tells them to take up their cross, give everything for him. There's nothing you wouldn't hold back. If he wanted you to do something, you would do it. If he wanted to take something out of your life, you would let him have it. He said, you let him boss you. It all kind of comes down to that. Will you let Jesus boss you and tell you what's right and tell you when something's not right and be your master and just go let him have all of it, your whole life? And he said, because if you don't, the reason you should do that is because if you try to save it, you lose it. But if you lose it, you find it. This is really what you want. It's really what you want. It's really what everybody in your life wants. They want you to love Jesus more than you love them. And It's what he wanted the whole time. And, you know, the whole thing is free. The whole thing is free. You just believe in Jesus and you belong to him and you're forgiven and everything. But then he wants you. And he wants all of you. And you know what? He's a lion. He's going to have it. He is going to have, he's not going to stop until he has all of you. And when he does, you're going to know, this is the greatest day of my life. I've never been happier than this. This, I didn't know it, but this is what I wanted my whole life. And that's what I think the question is. Jesus said, I'm going to win this. Do you really want to fight me? I'm going to win this. You need to count up. If you think you can build a tower and protect yourself from me, you're not going to be able to do it. If you think you can be a king on a throne, and you can send out an army against me. Not mean Jesus. The living, dying, and he's alive forevermore. God, who loved you to the point of death and who gave everything for you. If you think you can beat me, you need to count the cost of this. How painful do you want to make this? Because I'm going to win. He will. It's what you've always wanted. You want him to win. You know, I thought maybe we could just take some time and we're going to sing something. There was this girl. There was a girl. I read about her life. Her name was Bonnie Witherall. And she and her husband went to Moody Bible Institute. People always said of her, she was this redheaded girl, and her husband Gary, and they got married, and they worked in a bank, and the guy, their pastor, he just said, she was the sunniest person in all the world, and just her smile, and she laughed all the time, and just hilarious, and he said, I just really, really grew to love them, and they wound up being missionaries with the China, with the Christian Mission and Alliance in Lebanon, and they worked in Sidon. And for her, you know, there were so many things that happened they didn't expect. She said, I feel like I'm following Jesus down this blind alley in the dark. But I'll follow him anywhere. And she started, they started this, it was a clinic for mothers, for pregnant women, a women's clinic. And she said, you know, they were so poor, the Palestinian women there. And they just gave them everything and loved on them and loved on those women. And she said, you know, she wrote in her own journal, to fulfill our mission and purpose in life, we must do what he asked. The only way to know that is just to surrender our will to him. She was killed. She was killed on the 21st of November, shot in the face by a person who didn't want them there in their country. On 2002, and she died. She had written in her journal, Lord, we're here. How many people will die in the city of Sidon without knowing you? How can I worry about my life? Or when tens of thousands of people will die without knowing you? My life is hidden with you. I know you. I have the truth. There is nothing they could ever take from me. Somebody asked her one time, they said, what would you like to have written on your tombstone? She said, I want this. She lived life to the full. That's what you want. This is how you get it. And I just thought maybe we could take some time. And if Jesus, you know, if he were passing through this room, which he's here, you know, and he were to say to you, you know, that thing, I want it. You know that thing that you're doing? I want you to stop it. I want you to stop it. Let me boss you. It's what your heart longs for. It's what people in your life are waiting for. And you know, if you have something like that, just tell them. Tell them, I want you to boss me.